The tour content from now through Pesach has been sponsored by the Kofsky family in loving memory of Adira, who loved big ideas and asking big questions.
Okay, so this is a very weighty shear, okay, on a big topic. It's something I've wanted to give shear on for a while, but then Elisheva requested that we talk about it in Lomdeha, and so I thought this was a perfect opportunity. I have a feeling that this is going to be a two-session. No, not I have a feeling. I know for sure there's going to be a two-session shear. I didn't plan it like that, but I tried cramming everything in, and then when I gave the shear last night, I realized it's going to be when I tried going through in yeshiva, it's going to be longer than one part. So what I want to do is do half of it and then like give a sneak peek of the last half so you see a full picture, and then we'll have to continue it next time. Okay, so the title of the shear is How the Seemingly Outdated Elements of Torah Are Evidence of Its Perfection. Okay. Oh, that thing at the bottom is false. I don't have a written version of this shir yet. That was left over from last week. Okay. But first, let's do a word of the day. Okay. In order to get into the picture, what does the word obsolete mean?
Has no purpose.
Okay. That's half true. Half true. Obsolete means that
it's like not like old, but like.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a combination of both of those. Okay. So it's no longer used or produced or out of date, meaning it had a purpose and no longer does have a purpose. Okay, so for example, the rise of the internet has made phone books obsolete, right? Who has phone books and uses phone books anymore? Some believe that COVID-19 will make handshakes obsolete. Mr. Shokrat's overhead projector is destined for obsolescence. Obsolescence is the noun, meaning that it's going to fade away from time, okay, and not be used anymore. And then an idiom of the day, I don't know if you're familiar with this. It started off as a, I think, software development idiom, and then it was mainstream. Have you heard of this phrase, it's not a bug, it's a feature? You can guess what it means, because what is it, if you know what a bug is in like in computer lingo. Okay, so what it is, that's not an adjective, it's an idiom. So used by software developers to convince either truthfully or dishonestly that an apparent flaw in their program is not a bug, meaning it's not a malfunction, but it's a feature, meaning it's a beneficial function. So I couldn't come up with a really good example, but I feel like there are certain moms who do this. My mom does this, is she likes setting clocks in the house 10 minutes fast. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. So you could say, I noticed your mom's clock is 10 minutes fast. Yeah, but the way she sees it, it's not a bug, it's a feature, since it ensures that she'll arrive early. So in other words, it's something that looks like it is malfunctioning, but really it has an advantage or reflects an advantage by design, okay? So that's, it's not a bug, it's a feature. So with that in mind, here, oh, sorry, another thing, one more, okay, intro. Is, again, this series is called Machshava Lab. We are exploring and doing experiments and trying to find answers to difficult questions. And this is a work in progress, but especially for this year, Pesach is coming up, and we have the Ben Chacham, the Ben Rasha, the Ben Tam, and the Eino Dei Lishol. So the Ben Chacham you answer, the Ben Rasha you answer, the Ben Tam you answer, but what does the Haggadah to say that you do with the Eino Dei Lishol? It doesn't actually say you answer him, it says something else.
You tell him about
this story.
Yeah, ad pataklo. So what does ad pataklo mean?
You have to start the conversation.
You start the conversation, okay, right? So it says ad pataklo, you start a conversation. So it's not the same thing as an answer, which answer obviously, you know, obviously that should ideally be a conversation also. But, you know, you don't give him an answer. You just initiate the conversation for him. So when we have this year today, let's view this as the start of a conversation that will last hopefully, you know, at least into two sessions, but hopefully like many more things, because you'll see why, like, to truly do justice to this topic would involve going through every mitzvah that you have a question on. Okay, but we're going to try to do a broad overview. So here are the objectives. Number one, initiate a conversation about the broad, deep, and nuanced topic of seemingly outdated aspects of Torah Judaism. And just as a terminology point, when I say Torah through this entire thing, I mean Judaism. I mean Torah, I mean Judaism as a whole. I don't mean like specifically Oraisa versus Derabana. I'm talking about all of Judaism. So that's what we're going to talk about. Two is I'm going to present you with an overview of my own answer to questions of that nature, which basically is based on seven premises that I have about Torah. And we will aim to get through four of those seven premises today. Okay. That's the halfway point. And then we will, throughout the course of this, talk about some examples of things that are outdated in Torah and how my answer addresses that, but we cannot allow ourselves to go into depth because then we're going to lose the forest for the trees. Then we're going to end up getting bogged down in particular mitzvahs. And my goal is to convey the general approach. And if we want, we could take up particular topics later on. Okay. Last point is we did a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos or a Brisa really about Omer Dover B'Shem Omro, that you should say something in the name of the person who said it. So I have to give a quasi B'Shem Omro shout out to someone named Rabbi Chaim Angel. So there's a thing that happens in science and in math and in other areas called multiple discoveries, I think they call it, or multiple simultaneous discoveries, where sometimes two people will discover the same thing independently of each other. So like, I believe Newton and Leibniz, I don't know how to say it, both discovered calculus independently of each other. Or like Darwin and Wallace came up with the theory of evolution, like completely apart. So basically I came up with this theory a while ago and been working on it. And then I read this book this year by Rabbi Chaim Angel called Cornerstones. And he has a chapter and it's like almost exactly what I said. But when I read it, he had other examples that I hadn't thought of. And he had certain terminology that I hadn't thought of. And so I can no longer remember exactly which elements I got from his book and which elements I thought of on my own and just like refined with his stuff. So I'm just giving him a broad shout out in case like there's credit that goes to him. Okay. Okay. So let's start off by making a list. Okay. Let's come up with a list of mitzvos or values or ideas or institutions in the Torah that are regarded as obsolete, okay? Not necessarily that you hold are obsolete, but that people think of as obsolete or worse. Meaning there are certain things in the Torah that just like they look outdated, but then other things that look like they actually go against what we view as being moral, okay? So let's come up with a list, not a full list. Okay, we're not gonna go through every mitzvah, but what comes to mind when you think of this category?
Korbanos.
Okay, korbanos, right? Good, what else?
Hell, you stole mine.
Slavery?
What did you say? I didn't hear who even talked.
They all said slavery.
I said slavery.
Okay, good. Is that it?
Beged Ish and Beged Isha?
Okay, good. Beged Ish / Beged Isha, you know, I should put these in translation form also. So sacrifices. So this is prohibitions against cross dressing. Okay.
More than one wife.
Okay, good. Polygamy, right? More than one wife.
We could say the way like the institution of marriage was set up back then.
Okay, do you have specific elements of that in mind? Because I think maybe they could break that down.
I don't know. Maybe the
virgin being encouraged to marry her rapist.
Okay, good. Right. So a rape victim marrying her rapist. Okay. Yeah, that's a big one. let's say. So, Alicia, like, were you thinking of things like in terms of like the asymmetry in marriage, like the fact that the man has to give the get to the woman, and you know, or let's say like some people view like kiddushin, the fact that the man does the act of kiddushin, you know. So like, is that the type of thing you meant, or you meant something else?
Yeah, I meant that. Also, like, I guess connected to polygamy, like the way it was set up, that it was kind of the guy was in the power.
Okay, so let's say the male. Male dominant setup of marriage and other stuff, right? We could just say others, like there's probably other cases like that, like you know, you know, the issue of women and srara, right? In certain types of actually I could add that women and srara authority positions. Okay.
Even like Pesach.
What about Pesach?
I meant sukkahs, like that is set up around the harvest season.
Okay, yeah, good. So agricultural mitzvos and focus, right? That those are definitely, we don't live in an agricultural society anymore, at least most people in the world.
Like the laws of a Kohen and like the Beis Hamikdash and Mishkan.
Yeah, lots of Kohanim, Mikdash related stuff.
Certain of a desire prohibition.
Okay, good. I was going to say there's two major categories that no one's mentioned, okay? Lots of Avodah Zara, idolatry stuff that is irrelevant. And what's like the biggest category, I guess, other than you know, women issues? What's the biggest thing that people are bothered by nowadays, like in the last, like, you know, 20 years?
Oh, like Arayos?
Yeah, okay. Is sexual prohibitions. Now, some of them I think people are still okay with. Like, I've never heard anyone complain about the prohibitions against incest or bestiality, but specifically LGBTQ matters, right? That's a big thing that is viewed as obsolete or outdated or bad. Okay, now I'm sure there are more, but this is the type of thing that I'm talking about. And again, we're going to have to resist the temptation to go fully into each of these topics because each of these could be its own shear. Okay, but what we are going to do is keep these in mind when I go over the main idea here, and then we'll maybe dip superficially into them in order to clarify the main ideas. Okay, so here we go. As I said, the answer that I have for approaching this whole area is based on seven premises about Torah. Now, the first one is going to be one that seems obvious, but we need to talk about it. Okay, premise number one, the Torah is perfect, cannot be added to or detracted from, and is binding for all time. Okay, now, when I say perfect, I don't mean that if you think you see a problem in it, then you should just like slap yourself and tell yourself that it's perfect. Okay, because obviously if that were the case, then we wouldn't be giving this shear, right? What would I say to you? I would just say, oh, the Torah's perfect, get over it, you know? So what I mean is I'm gonna show you what the way that the Rambam and the Sefer Chinuch say it is. So first of all, this is one of the 13 Ikarim. That's why it's a fundamental. The Rambam calls this the principle of bittul, which means nullification or negation. He says, namely, that this Torah of Moshe will not be rendered null and void, and there will not come any other Torah from Hashem, and there cannot be anything added to or detracted from it, neither in its writing nor in its interpretation. As it is stated, do not add to it and do not detract from it. So what I mean is the Torah, there's only one Torah and there's only ever going to be one Torah. It cannot change, it cannot be replaced, it cannot be negated. Okay, that's the premise I'm working with. And I also wanted to state this as like a disclaimer. When we talk about mitzvot being obsolete, I do not mean that the mitzvot are not binding. Okay, what I mean is, for example, you know, like if you have a mitzvah that, let's say slavery, right? So slavery is not something that is you know, accepted nowadays, and there's virtually no slavery. I don't mean that the laws of slavery have been taken away from Torah. I mean that it's practically irrelevant, but it still is binding, okay? And same thing for everything else. So no one should misconstrue anything in this year as saying that we should tamper with halakha, okay? Halakha is 100% binding, and Torah is there for all time, and we're not going to get another Torah, and don't add or subtract to Torah, okay? So that's this. Now, here's the question. Why, other than the mitzvah of adding or detracting from Torah, why do we hold... What leads us to believe that the Torah is perfect? This is a kind of obvious or basic question.
It was given by God.
It was given by God. Okay, right. So this is how the Sefer Chinuch gives the reason for the mitzvah of Bal Tosif and Bal Tigra. At the root of this mitzvah lies the reason that the Lord who commands us about the Torah, blessed is He, is the very ultimate perfection, and all His works and all His commandments are wholly perfect and good. Any addition to them is a defect, and all the more so is any detraction. This is a clear matter. So He is explicitly tying the perfection of Torah to the perfection of Hashem. Now, obviously, Hashem is perfect in a way that the Torah can't be, because Hashem is not physical, and Hashem is, you know, the creator of the physical world. But what it means is that everything Hashem creates is going to be the most perfect that it can be, okay, given the limitations of the physical world and human beings, etc. Okay, and we've been talking about this a lot in Eov. So if you're in my Eov Shir, or have been in my Eov Shir, then that's to your advantage. Okay, so that's the first premise here. Anyone have any? I think this is fairly easy to talk about. Anyone have any questions on this one? Okay. Second premise. And this is the one that's the hardest pill to swallow. Okay. The Torah was designed with reference to the norm, not to exceptional cases. Okay. And we're going to read from the Rambam for this. Okay. So first of all, let's see how much you remember. I should have put the Rabag's definition in here. Let's just review. What's the Rabag's definition of Torah?
A God-given regimen that brings those who practice it properly true success, i.e. knowledge of God, to the extent which is possible.
Beautiful. Okay. I don't even need to repeat it because it's word for word. Okay, good. And this, I think, was also in the Torah Baal Peh thing. Mitzvos are designed to perfect us in three ways. And maybe this is not there, but anyone, does that ring a bell? There are three types of benefits that mitzvos have.
Social relationships.
Good. Social relationships. Did you say something else? What was the other thing?
Midos.
Knowledge of it. And knowledge. Okay, good. So I don't think I ever showed you the source inside. So the Rambam says in the Mornevukim 3:31, the sole object of the Torah is to benefit us. Every one of the 613 mitzvot serves A, to inculcate some good idea or remove some bad idea, B, to establish a just principle, meaning like justice, or to remove injustice, C, to guide us in accordance with a good trait or to warn against a bad trait. Everything depends on three things: ideas, morals, and social conduct. These three principles suffice for assigning a reason for every one of the divine commandments. And then, as Eli Sheva quoted from the Ralbag, the purpose of all of these things is to produce a society in which individuals can attain the knowledge of God to the extent possible, which is the purpose of man, so to speak. Okay, so that's what the purpose of Torah is. Okay, however, here's the part that's a hard pill to swallow. It is also important to know, this is in a different chapter in the Morning of Bookim 3:34, it is also important to note that the Torah does not take into account exceptional circumstances, and commandments are not based on minority conditions. Whatever the Torah teaches, whether it be of an intellectual, a moral, or a practical character, is founded on that which is the rule and not on that which is the exception. Okay, so Torah is based on the normal cases, not the deviations from the norm, and this is the hard pill to swallow. It ignores the injury that might be caused to a single person through a certain Torah decree or precept. For the Torah, okay, let me pause that for 1 second here, okay? So what he's saying here is like this, is when the Torah is trying creates a mitzvah that is designed to give you a certain idea or mida or a just principle in society, the Torah is designed to help the majority of people, okay? And the minority of people may not be helped by that, and they may even be injured by it. And I think I've given this example before. For some reason, the most powerful example that comes to mind is fasting. Okay, so what's the general purpose of why we fast on Yom Kippur, let's say?
Tshuva.
To facilitate tshuva, right? And you can explain how it facilitates tshuva, puts us in a weakened state, makes us remember that we're our physical needs are dependent on God, makes us realize our mortality, subdues our taivas, okay? So for the majority of people, fasting is an unpleasant experience, but is conducive to tshuva, okay? However, there are people on both sides of the fasting thing. So for example, for some people, fasting is extremely easy, okay? And let's say, for example, for me, on a regular fast day, like very easy, and I don't suffer very much from it. And then on the other extreme, you've got people like, I think I mentioned this woman to you, that there's a woman in my shul in Seattle, that when she fasts on Yom Kippur, she gets so sick that she vomits blood. Now, I think if you ask, I always say that she should ask her Rav for Psak, because I don't think she should fast. Okay, but let's put it this way. I guarantee you, she's not able to concentrate on doing tshuva, you know? Now, is that bad for her? Yeah, it's bad for her. And again, the halakhic system, I think, would exempt her, which we'll talk about later. But the point is that fasting does not help everyone, okay? But the law about fasting was not designed for everyone. It was designed for the majority of people. It's obligatory on everyone, but it was designed with the majority of people in mind. Here's another easy example. Okay. Mitzvah of tefillin shel yad. Okay. Putting tefillin on your arm. That was designed for everyone except for. Okay. It was designed for all men except for.
Men with no arms.
Men with no arms. Right. Now, the Torah theoretically could have created leg tefillin for people with no arms, but that's not how the Torah works. The Torah creates a mitzvah and applies it to the category based on the norm. And there will be cases where the person will not be able to do the mitzvah or won't benefit from the mitzvah or maybe even be injured by the mitzvah. Okay. And again, we're going to talk about this later on. This is not the end of the story. Okay. But that's the general principle here. And then the Rama makes a point that is directly related to what we talked about in Eov last week, which is For the Torah is a divine institution, and in order to understand its operation, we must consider how in nature the various forces produce benefits which are general, but in some solitary cases they cause injury. So, for example, that's when we use the example of the traffic lights, that traffic lights are for the benefit of the system to facilitate safe and efficient travel, but what and traffic lights have red and green lights, but are red lights always good? No. Sometimes you get stuck in a red light and you're late for something very important, you know, or sometimes the changing of the light leads to people, you know, trying to make it through and then they get into an accident, you know. Similar thing in nature, right? When the body has a fever, that's a good thing because whatever you say the benefits of fever are, that the body is raising its own internal temperature to kill off certain bacteria, et cetera. That's generally good. But what sometimes happens, sometimes a baby will die if it has a fever. Now, does that mean that fevers are poorly designed? No. What it means is that in this particular case, maybe the baby was slightly underweight. Maybe the baby was dehydrated. Maybe the baby didn't have like its nutrients. In that particular case, it's bad for that baby. But that doesn't mean that fevers are a bad idea. Fevers are a good idea, but sometimes will result in bad cases. And the Rambam is saying that Hashem made nature, Hashem made Torah, and they function in similar ways. Okay. Let's read on, and then you'll tell me if you have any questions, because there's two more points here. We must consequently not be surprised when we find that the objectives of the Torah do not fully appear in every individual. There must, of absolute necessity, be people who are not perfected by the institution of the Torah, just as there are beings which do not receive the specific forms in nature that they require. For all this comes from one God and is the result of one act. They are all given from one shepherd, from Koheles. It is impossible to be otherwise, and we have already explained that which is impossible always remains impossible and never changes. Okay, so again, I kind of made this point verbally, but like, you know, there will be people, for example, who, you know, you have this mitzvah of Ahavas Hashem, right, of loving God, and it, according to the Rambam, it's based on knowledge of science, okay, primarily. Knowledge of Torah secondarily, but knowledge of science primarily. There will be people who just, let's say someone who is... has some sort of mental disability, they might never be able to do the mitzvah of Ahavas Hashem, right? They just might not have the mind to do that. Or let's say you have someone who is, you have Isser of Nivel Peh, right? Of saying like certain types of bad language, right? There are people with Tourette syndrome, okay? And they can't control the fact that they will reflexively swear, you know? That's not bad. It's just that the Torah is not going to benefit them through the mitzvah of Nivel Peh. So there must be cases like this because it's the same as in nature. All right. And that's the point that the Rambam's making. All right. Any questions on this so far? Because the next point is going to take us into the third premise. Okay. And again, just to be absolutely clear, when the Rambam says that there are people who are not perfected by the instruction of Torah, does that mean that those parts of Torah are that they're exempt from those? Absolutely not. Everyone is obligated in Torah, and even if it doesn't perfect you in that area. And it's a separate question, like, what are you supposed to do if you are obligated in a mitzvah, but that mitzvah is harmful to you, okay? That's something that we will partially deal with today, but I think that could also be another topic, okay? So just, like, file that away. We're going to have to keep lots of threads going on here because we have to keep our eye on the prize here. All right, now the Rambam makes another point, which is going to segue to our next point. From this consideration, it also follows that the laws cannot, like medicine, vary according to the different conditions of persons and times. Whilst the cure of a person depends on his particular constitution at the particular time, the divine guidance contained in the Torah must be certain and general, although it may be effective in some cases and ineffective in others. If the Torah depended on the varying conditions of man, it would be imperfect in its totality, each precept being indefinite. So I'm going to give you two analogies here. Okay, let's say Hashem, instead of giving a Torah to all of us, came down and appeared in a vision to Leah, okay, and said, I'm going to design a Torah specifically for you. And then Hashem appeared to Ayala and said, I'm going to design a Torah specifically for you. And then another Torah specifically for Elisheva and so on, okay? Would those Torahs be the same? No. Okay, now let's be more specific. In what sense would they be the same, and in what sense would they be different?
The values would be the same, but the
values would be the same. Okay, good. And in what sense would they be different?
The means of accomplishing those values.
The means of accomplishing them, exactly, right? So let's say, for example, like, you know, you guys have different strengths and weaknesses. You have different mitos. Some of you have, let's say, a hard time with like anger. Some of you have a hard time with laziness. Sometimes some of you have an easy time with generosity. Some of you have an easy time with like discipline, you know? So if you had a personal Torah, it would be tailor-made to fit you, and it would be a regimen for your success as a human being. Okay. But what happens if Hashem wanted to make a Torah? What would Hashem have to do if he wanted to make a Torah for just all Lomdeha students? How would that differ from the individual personalized Torahs? What would he have to do when he was designing it?
I guess for the majority of us.
Yeah, it would have to be stuff for the majority. So either there might be certain laws that don't really have a benefit for all of you, or he would have to like cut back on how broadly he's aiming. And instead of making it like, let's say, for example, like let's say Hashem knows that Leia is capable of like learning 5 prakim a night. So Hashem would you know, for her, Leia's mitzvah of Talmud Torah, say, okay, Leia, learn 5 prakim a night, you know? But let's say for another student, they can learn like 10 prakim, you know? So what would Hashem have to do? He would probably go for the common denominator, right? And only obligate 5 prakim, and then like 10, you know, the other, you know, 10 prakim would be like beyond the letter of the law, okay? So in other words, the more particular the recipient, the more tailor-made it can be, but the more general the recipient, then the broader it can be. And if the Rambam is saying, if the Torah depended on the varying conditions of man, it would be imperfect in its totality, each precept being left indefinite. So here's an example of this, okay? Speed limits. So the purpose of speed limits, again, is to facilitate safe and effective travel. You want it to be as fast as possible, but still be safe, okay? So let's say you have a speed limit of like 55 miles per hour, all right? So generally speaking, that's going to be good, but name a case where 55 miles per hour is going to end up being bad.
On Central Avenue.
On Central Avenue. Okay. Why?
It's like residential streets, and the speed limit is probably like 20 miles per hour.
Okay. Right. So let's say you get through, this is annoying. When I went through cross country, there would be times when like you'd be driving at, it'd be 55 miles per hour. And then like one street, it would go down to 25 and then it'll go back to 55, you know? So, but think of a case in which like it would be bad for you to drive at 55 miles per hour, not based on the, like, let's say it's an area where it's not residential. What would be a case where it's not safe or not efficient for you to drive at 55 miles per hour?
You had bad eyesight?
Okay, let's say you have bad eyesight. That's a perfect example, right? Let's say you have bad eyesight and like you can't see very far. So maybe you should drive slower. And if you drove at 55, that would be harmful. Or maybe you're in a situation where like, you know, it's an emergency and you need to violate the speed limit, right? You need to like drive faster than that. Okay. So why don't they just make a law that instead of having a sign that says 55 miles per hour, why don't you just have a law that says drive safely? What would be wrong with that? And that would allow for variety. Then you could just like tailor, make it to fit the needs. So what's wrong with that?
First, people may not know.
Yeah, Ayala Fader, go ahead.
So two things, I think. One, people may not know what is safe for them. And also, if everyone's driving at different speeds, like it'll just make the road unsafe.
Okay, good. So those exact two things. Number one is people are bad at making value judgments, okay? They might misevaluate it. So you force them to do something which is generally safe instead of leaving it up to their decision to do what they think is safe. And secondly, there's no uniformity. In order to have a system, there needs to be a uniformity. You can't just have everyone doing what they think is right. That's the purpose of a law, is to make everyone conform to one generally good thing instead of just leaving it up to everyone. Okay. So that was the second point, is that when the Torah is designed, and again, and I'm using from these examples because this is not just Torah, you realize, okay? All legal systems are going to be designed with reference to the normal cases within that legal system. When they make speed limits, they don't make a little like footnote on the speed limit that says, this does not apply to someone who has bad eyesight, you should drive slower. They just make one law that applies to everybody, you know? And when they make an exception to the law that's legal, then they have to design that for the majority of cases. Okay. So this is not like a God thing. This is not a Judaism. This is not a Torah thing. This is a legal thing. Okay. Any questions on this point?
I have a question.
Yes.
Well, you know, with legal systems, they're optional. You can either, you know, choose to live in a state or in the locale and participate in this legal system or not. The store, right. Whether, you know, whether it agrees with you or not, you're still obligated. Right.
Okay, that's a good question. And I suppose I did not think to address that in this shear because I didn't think it was part of my answer. Let me think about it for 1 second and see if I should address it now or not. Let's actually put that on the back burner also in terms of why the Torah allows you to convert in but not convert out. Okay, it's a good question, but I think it would take us too far afield. All right, any other questions on this? Okay, the third point follows directly from the last one, which is just like the Torah is designed with reference to the norm among human beings, the Torah is designed to accomplish its goals to the greatest extent in all times, places, and cultures. Now, the Rambam we just read is this. The Rambam then goes on right after it and says, for this reason, it would not be right to make the fundamental principles of the Torah dependent on a certain time or a certain place. On the contrary, the statutes and the judgments must be definite, unconditional, and general. Now, you can see how all three premises are tied together, that the Torah is eternal and unchanging, it's designed for the majority of, for the norm and not the exceptional cases, and it's designed for the majority of times and places and not the minority, okay? And for this, oh, sorry, hold on just a second. These three premises are embodied in something that I am proud of, and this is something that the whole shir came together from this, which is, oh, hold on just 1 second. Okay, I have to stop sharing. I got to remind people, I cannot see the chat while I am talking, so I'm not going to read the chat, so I don't know if those are for me or not. But okay, so there's here's a mashal, okay? This is what we're going to call the Swiss Army knife mashal, okay? This is a Swiss Army knife. It's personalized, okay? So Swiss Army knife, I don't know how many of you have used or played around with it, but you've got different tools on it, and I'm going to show you them. My hands are all sweaty. Hold on. So here you have a corkscrew, okay? Here you have a bottle opener, okay? Here you have a Phillips screwdriver, and then let me just do two more. Hold on, I got to find the ones. This is very important which tools I show you for the purpose of the muscle. Okay. Okay. You've got scissors, okay? Now, here's the thing. With a Swiss Army knife, some tools are exactly the same as the normal version of the tool. Okay, so for example, this Phillips screwdriver, like the actual screwdriver part, is exactly the same as any Phillips screwdriver, and it works just as well. Okay, this bottle opener is an exact normal bottle opener; it works just as well as any other. Okay, the corkscrew, not so much. The corkscrew is a little shorter than a normal corkscrew, and I've tried to use this before, and you probably can't tell. It gets a little bent out of shape. Okay. The scissors are horrible. Okay. I don't know if you've ever tried using Swiss Army knife scissors, and maybe some of them are good. These are horrible. Like I can't even I don't even think this is gonna, no, it doesn't even cut. Okay. Like maybe if I really want to try, it would cut. If you ever use a nail file on Swiss Army knife, it's like virtually like useless. Okay. So the question is, and this is an obvious question, if the scissors are so bad, why did they include scissors in the Swiss Army knife?
Because the Swiss Army knife is designed for like getting you out of any situation, and you never know when you might need a scissor.
Exactly. Okay. So the if their goal was to make the best scissors, so then they wouldn't make the scissors like this. But the greatness of a Swiss Army knife is you have all the tools you need in one, and in order to fit them into one, you need to, some of the tools can be fit into one, some of them need to be compromised, and some of them need to be limited or restricted in different ways in order to be able to fit them all into one, okay? So too, this is the main idea of today's part of this year, okay? So too with the Torah, okay? Let's go back to our PowerPoint here. So too with the Torah, okay? If you got a Torah that was designed for you specifically, then the Torah would be absolutely perfect. It would be like, to borrow the Rambam's mashal, if you have a doctor who is prescribing a specific regimen for you and your body and your circumstances, it would be perfect and it would achieve its goals with 100% efficiency, okay? However, Torah was not designed just for you, and it wasn't just designed for the people in Lomdeha, not just designed for the Jews in New York, not just designed for the Jews in the United States. It was designed to accomplish its goals for all Jews in all times, in all cultures, in all places, to the greatest extent possible over thousands of years. Okay. And in order for that to happen, certain mitzvot are going to be just as effective anywhere, no matter what. Okay. So name one mitzvah that achieves its purpose equally in all societies, regardless of like when or where or what. I mean, just name an example.
Loving the ger.
Tzedakah.
Okay. Loving ger and tzedakah. Okay. Let's think about these two examples. Okay. Cause I think you can make an argument on both sides. Let's take, loving the ger is definitely relevant in all societies, right? But in certain society, which societies are going to need that mitzvah more?
Societies with gayer.
Societies with what? I just didn't hear you. All right, someone else can answer. Which society will need that mitzvah?
Societies with more gayer.
Okay, societies with more gayer. Let's say that. Okay, but let's say you have two
homogenous societies.
Okay, yeah. Societies that are homogenous, where everyone is the same, and therefore there is greater fear, greater prejudice, greater, like, you know, intolerance for the outsider, right? But if you have a very diverse society or society that values human equality, then you might not need that mitzvah, might not serve as great of a purpose because people will be doing it naturally, okay? Let's take tzedakah, all right? Tzedakah is necessary in all societies because all societies have people who are poor and all societies have some form of currency, okay? Or some form of like need, okay? Remember, tzedakah is not just money. It's also providing clothing and food, et cetera, right? So that's gonna be an example that is going to be, lend itself to almost all societies equally, okay? But then you've got other mitzvahs, let's say like the agricultural ones that we mentioned, that in an agrarian society, these are very important. But in our society where a very small percentage of us are farmers, those parts of the Torah are largely irrelevant to us, you know? So when Hashem is making the Torah, what population is he going to aim for in designing most mitzvos? How would you describe like the target audience of the Torah?
General population.
The general population through all time and all places. Okay. In other words, it's the lowest common denominator in terms of the Torah has to be able to accomplish its goals to the greatest extent possible in the most times and the most places. And what will you inevitably have? And this is the crux to understanding the answer to the question. You will inevitably have cases where you have a society that is an anomaly, a society where it is something that is like unheard of in terms of the norm. Okay. And I'm going to use a weird example. Okay. And I don't know much about this. I know that it's mixed with history and myth. But let's say the Amazons. Okay. Like the Amazon female warriors, right. Which I guess Wonder Woman was modeled after. Okay. Is that was a female dominated society. And there have been female dominated societies throughout human history, but they we can all admit that they were very rare, right? So the Torah is not designed for that society. The Torah is designed for most societies in which are male dominated. Now, I'm not saying that that's good, and I'm not saying that that's like ideal, and I'm not even saying that the Torah endorses it. I'm saying that what populations are we going to be dealing with? We're going to be dealing with populations where, let's say, the men are out and working, and like the women are raising the kids. Now, again, I'm not saying that that's ideal. I'm not saying that that's normal. I'm not saying that the Torah endorses it. But we can all agree that for the majority of human history in the majority of societies, that's how societies were. That's what the Torah was designed to accommodate. Okay, what we do with that, we'll talk about it later. Okay, but one step at a time. Let's take another example. In most societies, let's not take another example yet. I want to go into the next point, okay? And then maybe if we have time, we'll go through examples. All right. Is this point clear, though, with the Swiss Army knife muscle? Okay. The last new point we're going to do today before I'm going to preview everything, but this last new point is addressing the question. When the Rambam says that the Torah could be injurious, can cause injury to minority cases, okay? The question is, what about cases like that, okay? What about cases where the Torah is harming a person or a society? What do we do about that, okay? So premise number four is The Torah has mechanisms for situational tweaking. Okay. So what I mean is in cases where the Torah is not beneficial in a particular case or is injurious, there are solutions. So here is a list of solutions, okay? And this is, it might not be all of them, okay? The best solution, hold on just a second. The best solution is the ability of a Navi to temporarily suspend mitzvos, okay? And I want to show you the halakha. So first of all, you have a mitzvah in a mitzvah d'oraisa to obey a Navi, okay? To do whatever he says, as long as you've established him as a Navi. So Rambam in the Sefer Mitzvah says this 172nd mitzvah is the commandment to obey every one of the prophets and to fulfill everything he commands us in, even if he commands us to transgress one of the several or several mitzvahs of the Torah, except for Avodah Zarah, provided that this is temporary and that he doesn't permanently institute an addition or subtraction. So the Navi can temporarily suspend any mitzvah except for Avodah Zarah, and he can temporarily create a mitzvah except for one that would make you do Avodah Zarah, and as long as it's not a permanent change to Torah. Okay, now, why is this? So the Rabbah gives this amazing explanation. He says, there's another benefit in this mitzvah, specifically regarding cases in which the prophet commands us to transgress certain mitzvahs at certain times. Even though the Torah generally guides the nation towards the good, it is possible that in certain cases it would be better to deviate from some of its mitzvahs. So again, Rabbah is agreeing with the Rambam that the mitzvahs are generally good, but there are cases when keeping the mitzvahs is harmful, okay? Since Hashem, may he be exalted, desire the greatest good at all times for his nation, he identified for Israel through his prophets that which needs to be changed from time to time, something which was impossible to do within the Torah itself. So the Torah itself must be permanent. Torah cannot change itself. So Hashem gave us Nevi'im, and the Nevi'im, through their Nevuah from Hashem, can see when does the Torah need to be temporarily modified, and the Navi can temporarily modify it, and that is 100% good because you're obeying a Navi, okay? And it's 100% good because it comes from Hashem, okay? So this is essentially when Hashem himself tweaks the system in order to bring about a benefit when the benefit wouldn't have come across. Now, does this remind you of anything? Can you think of any other case in the world, not in halakha, where when the system would be bad, Hashem intervenes and tweaks it?
Miracles.
Miracles. Okay. So the Rabbah says this is similar to the idea of miracles, which Hashem brings about through his prophets, namely that Hashem set up nature in such a manner as to achieve the general good through each of the natural laws. But since in certain cases it would be better to deviate somewhat from this natural order, Hashem, may he be exalted, saw fit that this should be done through the prophets at a time of need. So for example, water is really good. The fact that water flows is very good. The fact that oceans do oceany things is very good. But you might get into a rare circumstance where Bnei Israel are being chased by the Mitzrayim and they're being blocked by water. So what does Hashem do? He temporarily suspends the laws of water, makes them part, allows the Jews to go, and he makes them go back again. So this is no different. Is that saying that nature is bad? No. Is it saying that nature is imperfect? No, in the sense that nature is as perfect as it can be as a physical thing. And this is, again, what we've been talking about in Eov, is the laws of nature are the most perfect that they can be, but they are material and they are systems, and they are bound by material laws because that's what material is, and they're bound by systems because that's what systems are, okay? You can't have a system that doesn't have systemic limitations. You can't have matter that doesn't have material properties. So the laws of nature are the best they can be, but in certain particular cases, they're bad, and Hashem will, through a miracle, you know, suspend them there. Same thing with mitzvos. Mitzvos are designed for a physical world, and they are a system. So they will have physical limitations and systemic limitations, but Hashem will get around them by sending a Navi to temporarily suspend them when necessary. Okay, so that's mechanism number one. Any questions on that mechanism? Okay, number two, the ability of a Sanhedrin to make a Hora'as Shah, to make a temporary halakha, okay? Now, I think you've heard of this, but I don't know whether you've seen these halakhas inside. So I want to show you inside in the Rambam. Okay, so the first category, so he introduces, he's talking about making gezeros and like fences for Torah and like how certain Beis Dins can overrule other Beis Dins. This is in Hilchos Mamrim 2:4. He says, the Supreme Court has the right to uproot even these things, the rabbinic laws, temporarily, even though they are similar, smaller than the original ones, because the decrees cannot be more stringent than the words of the Torah itself. For even matters of Torah may be uprooted by the court as a temporary policy. Okay, this is just to introduce you to the topic. Now he's going to spell it out. How so? How can the court, what can the court do? if the court sees fit that in order to strengthen the religion and to make offense, in order that people not transgress the Torah, they may administer extrajudicial whiplashes and punishments, meaning that halakha has a system of punishments, but let's say Beis Din sees that people are, I don't know, let's say there's something that like, you know, you can't get punished from Beis Din with, let's say like Lashon Hara, okay, you can't get punished from Beis Din from Lashon Hara because it's in speech. But let's say Beis Din sees a really bad Lashon Hara problem, they can make a temporary law to give people whiplashes for Lashon Hara. Okay, and as long as it's temporary, then that's fine. He says they cannot establish the matter for all generations, saying that the law is such. So this we know, okay? And we obviously know the concept of making a fence, right? Which is that if they see that people are in danger of violating Torah law, they can make a temporary fence to ensure that they don't violate it, okay? But this next part, people don't know about, okay? Likewise, if they see fit to temporarily suspend a positive mitzvah or to allow transgression of a negative mitzvah, in order to bring the multitudes back to the religion or to save the multitudes of Jews from stumbling in other matters, they may do so according to the needs of the time. Okay, I want you to stop and realize how radical this is. Let's read that again. Okay. Sanhedrin can temporarily suspend a positive mitzvah or allow transgression of a negative mitzvah in order to bring the multitudes back to the religion or to save the multitudes of Jews from stumbling in other matters. Okay, and they can do so temporarily. Now, without going into details, if we had a Sanhedrin today, what do you think would be some candidates for temporary suspensions of mitzvos in Torah? Think of what you would do if you were on the Sanhedrin, where there are things that if we just temporarily suspended it, maybe that would bring lots of Jews back into Judaism. What would you do if you were on the Sanhedrin, or what would you propose?
Like maybe stuff with clothing, like women's clothes and man's clothes, and like make it all acceptable. Or
okay, good. Let's say the major obstacle is certain restrictions on Beged Ish and Beged Isha. Okay, or let's expand that. I think because it's a controversial issue, I'll just talk about it here briefly. Let's expand that to all like, you know, LGBTQ issues. Right? It is possible. I'm not saying that this is what they would do, but it's possible that Chazal would temporarily introduce or suspend laws to bring those Jews back into the fold or to create some temporary solution that would allow them to live a life that is in line with halakha because Beis Din is temporarily suspending it and you know, make them part of the system, you know, in a more full way that they can live with. What would be another example of things? Think of major changes that you could do that would bring lots of Jews back to Judaism.
Maybe kosher.
Okay, maybe kosher, right? Let's expand it to the three big things, okay? Or three big things. Nida, kashrus, and Shabbos, okay? Let's say, for example, what would happen if the only obstacle for certain conservative or reformed Jews, and I'm not saying that this is the case, just hypothetically, let's say the only obstacle is electricity on Shabbos, keeping the laws of Nida, and then like strictures for kashrus. Okay, and let's say like the Sanhedrin decided to temporarily suspend those mitzvos, bring those Jews in, expose them to the beauty of Torah, and then on a like you know 10-year plan, let's say over the course of a century, gradually reintroduce like more and more strict law or remove those suspensions in order to make Jews come in. Okay, I just want you to realize how radical this rite is of Beis Din, that it literally allows them to tweak the system for the needs of the times. Okay. Yeah. Question?
Yeah. Is this like, can they do it for a specific group of people or once they make a change it's for everyone?
It's a good question. I think they can do it for a specific group of people because the Rambam mentions certain cases of Horasha that took place that were for specific groups of people, but I don't know for sure. I'm not familiar with the laws of how they make these Horasha. So don't take that with a grain of salt. Okay. I think they can do it for specific people though.
Do they have any recent examples of Bate Dinim doing something like this?
Yeah, that's a good question that I also don't know the answer to because I'm not familiar with the history of the last time we had a Sanhedrin. The only case I can think of is no, I can't even think of that. Yeah, I'll see if I can get back to you on that because I do know people who I can ask. But again, it wouldn't be very, very recent because we haven't had a Sanhedrin for a very long time. I forgot to include this important point. He ends off with a great analogy. Just as a doctor needs to amputate a certain person's hand or foot in order that he live, so too the court may authorize from time to time the transgression of some of the mitzvahs temporarily in order that all of them may be preserved. As the early sages said, desecrate one Shabbos so that many Shabbos can be kept. Beautiful analogy, right? Because you got a person who has an arm that has a disease. Sometimes you got to cut off the arm to save the body. Right? Same thing in Torah. Sometimes you got to cut off part of Torah to save the rest of Torah. Okay. The only difference is that Torah would be a temporary thing. The arm's never going to grow back. Okay. So that was number two. Now, what is the difference? Okay. What's the similarity is clear between one and two, right? Is that they have the right to temporarily suspend or add things. What is the difference in character between these two mechanisms?
I think Harasha is like when things are like, so something's really bad and like to temporarily suspend it. So I think the second one implies like something more negative.
Okay. It's entirely possible. And this is kind of dependent on Ilana's question of when have they used this? And then when have they used the Navi thing? I hear that. I guess the question is like this is, practically, these are the same, meaning that the Navi and the Sanhedrin have the same rights. So why are there two institutions, maybe is a better way of asking it. Like, why is it, if they can both, no, it's like this. If a Sanhedrin can do the same thing that a Navi does, why do you need this separate institution of a Navi, you know, having this right?
Maybe because the Navi's one is based on what Hashem tells him.
Yes. Okay, good. So the difference is like this, is the Navi is doing it based on Hashem, and that's why it's better. The Sanhedrin is doing it based on their own evaluations, and it's possible that Chazal can make a mistake, okay? For example, and I'm not saying that this is a mistake, okay? But as we know, it's usur. Okay, I'm not going to get to the practical things. We all know that there is an isur of engaging in taking certain types of medicine on Shabbos. Right, we're aware of that, right? What's the basis of that isser? That's midrabanan. What was the law behind the, or what's the reasoning of that derabanan? Why did they prohibit? Yeah.
Tochen, you grind the pills.
Tochen, because you grind the pills, right? Is that you might come to grind, and that's isser deraisa. Okay. Now here's the thing: we live in an era now where we don't grind our own medicine, and in fact, the medicine is ground ahead of time. Okay, and like you could easily arrange to get it on Shabbos, right? So. It's not a mistake of Chazal. They made the best law that they could at the time, given the knowledge of how medicine was practiced. But now we're at a point where that law is holding us back. And it would be the type of thing that presumably if the Sanhedrin had the power to undo, they would undo now. You know? So like, whereas with a Navi, you wouldn't get into a problem like this because the Navi would be able to give you laws that are from Hashem, tweak the laws based on knowledge from Hashem. Okay. I'm going to quickly speed through this last part because we're almost done. The next thing is the thing I know the least about, okay, which is Chazal have the ability to use the Midos HaTorah Nidreshes Behen, which is the method of interpreting Torah Shebichtav in line with the principles of Torah Shebaal Peh, to adapt the unchanging elements of Torah in new and creative ways to the present generation. This is something that there's a lot of machlokas about, which is how much right do Chazal have to introduce new derabanans or to interpret the Torah in ways that are based on their own ideas. Okay, you have people who hold that, you know, Chazal have very little right in this area, and people who hold that Chazal can essentially like interpret Torah Shebichtav however their consensus is, as long as it's based on true principles. So this is not a harasha. This is a matter of how we interpret Torah laws. Okay, and there's a lot of debate on this. My point is that there are some who hold that Chazal have a much broader right than we usually think of to interpret the laws from the Torah in ways that like are adaptable to the needs of the society. Okay, number four, halakhic peturim and heterim. This we're familiar with from just the practice of halakha. If a guy has no arm, we don't say, oh, you're violating the halakha tefillin. What do we say? Anus rachmana patre. We say you can't keep the law, therefore you're exempt. Okay. What about heterim? You know, so you have cases where let's say like, you know, it's usur to bathe on Tisha B'Av, right? To wash yourself on Tisha B'Av. But then you have a category, a halakhic category of an istinus. And an istinus is someone who is like very, very, very sensitive to any sort of dirt. So we say, oh, you have a heter to wash in certain ways on Yom Kippur. Okay, so these are within the halakhic system. You have the right to do this. All right, and this where we, you know, it's clear that happens a lot. Okay, number five is the most difficult to talk about: meta halakhic strategies. Okay, there are times when we advocate doing things that are against halakha, and we're advocating doing it in non-halakhic ways. For example, it is usur to write down Torah Shebaal Peh, but the Gemara says, "Eis lasos lashen hefer Torah Secha." They needed to violate Torah and write down Torah Shebaal Peh to save all of Torah. Okay, or there are cases, for example, of this is a rare case called avera lishma. Okay, where a person sees that doing an avera will like save the Jewish people in some way. And like, even though it's halakhically usur and there's no heter and there's no exemption, it's better to do the avera than to not do the avera. And then there are other cases, for example, which we're not going to get into now, where Chazal say, if you know 100% that you're going to sin and you can't control yourself, then it's better to dress in black, go to a city where no one knows you, and do a chait in a way that will not give make a chilul Hashem, rather than to cause a chilul Hashem. Now, there, Chazal are not saying that it's mutter to do that. You're definitely doing Isser, but they're giving you advice on how to do damage control, you know? So, and maybe there are more examples than this, but these are ways in which, you know, these are ways in which halakha accounts for these exceptional cases. Now, the unfortunate thing is we don't have access to the first three, okay? And whose fault is that? Us. Why? Because we got put into Gullus. Okay. We have not had Nevi'im or Sanhedrin for a very long time. And therefore, we are in a system that's frozen. And therefore, the only techniques we have are the last two categories, which are much, much, much more limited than the first three. Okay. So it's unfortunate, but what I want to show you is that God planned for a system that is very adaptable and flexible to address these cases, these exceptional cases. But we messed it up by removing from ourselves the ability to have a Sanhedrin and a Nevi'im. Okay. I want to quickly wrap up the shiur, and then I'll take questions afterwards if there are questions. Sneak peek of the next three points, just so you see the full picture. Okay. Again, we're trying to answer what do we do with these outdated areas of Torah or seemingly obsolete. Point number five is a big one, which is that the Torah works with human nature, not against it. And many institutions of Torah are based on that fact. The fact that if the Torah tried to override human nature, it would backfire or fail. And therefore, the Torah created its laws in ways that are in line with human nature, even negative aspects of human nature, in order to work with it and then hopefully elevate it. Okay, so that's number five. And those of you who have learned about this, let's say the Rambam Shita on Korbanos, some of you have had Shirim on slavery, you have ideas where this was done. So that's what we're going to talk about Bli Neder next time. Number six is very related. The Torah includes static and evolutionary morality. Evolutionary morality was a term that Rabbi Chaim Angel came up with, which is certain things in Torah, when you look at, it reflects the ideal values. You look at tzedakah, it's because tzedakah is valuable. You look at not oppressing the ger, it's because that's a value. Other things like polygamy and slavery, hold on a second, polygamy and slavery are in Torah, but do not reflect Hashem's values. Rather, Hashem wants mankind to evolve past that and to get to a point where they don't need those institutions anymore and that their values change. Okay, we'll have to talk about that next time. And then the last point is going to be that there are mitzvot in the Torah that have planned obsolescence, which means that Hashem designed it so that certain mitzvot will become irrelevant by nature because they are successful. Okay, and I'll give you a sneak peek of that right now. There are 51 mitzvot, according to the Rambam, I think, that are designed to uproot Avodah Zarah, okay? Let's say that the mitzvot are so successful that they get rid of Avodah Zarah from the world. So now what are you going to have? You're going to have 51 mitzvot that are practically obsolete. Now, is that a sign of the Torah's failure, or is it a sign of the Torah's success? Clearly, it's a sign of the Torah's success. Okay. And there are many mitzvot in this category that I think we just don't think about. Okay. So that's a sneak peek for next time. Hopefully this was useful for starting the discussion, and shiur's officially over, but I'll take questions if you have them now and you want to ask them now instead of leaving until next time. So have a good Shabbos for those who are leaving now.
Thank you.
I was just thinking aside from your example about, changing because, to accommodate conservative, whatever.
Yeah.
It seems like, when the Torah is like under attack, it seems like it goes the opposite, like it gets more strict.
Right.
In a lot of cases.
Right. So not, in many yeah, in many cases that's true, but again, we don't know. When you're just relying on the Sanhedrin, then it's good to err on the side of being more strict, because we see what happened to Reform and Conservative when they were more permissive. It just didn't work, and then the system died out, you know? So yeah, that's why we tend to be more strict. But conceivably, then there could be a situation like, here, I'll give you a good example, okay? Let's say, you know, you have the situation with Ethiopian Jews, which it seems like they actually did descend from Shevet Dan, okay? And it's complicated because, like, they have to go through conversions, and like they're viewed as like not legitimate by some people.
Yeah.
You could conceive of a situation where a Navi is here and he just says, dang, all of them are instantaneously, you know, Jewish, will suspend the laws or whatever of conversion. I don't know what a Navi could have, you know? And like a one-shot deal where like you include a bunch of people, and once they're in, then they're in, you know? Or like, let's say for example, you know, like Ezra, and again, I don't know what this happened, but Ezra's biggest problem when he helped the Jews return was intermarriage, you know, and like the Kohanim were intermarried, you know, with non-Jews and stuff. And it caused a huge like delay of like starting up the Beit HaMikdash.
Right, right.
Maybe like he could have, you know, again, I mean, he was actually like, you know, there was a Sanhedrin there and everything. I'm just giving examples where like I could conceive of a case where like a mass, you know, leniency would help, like, just, you know, usher them in, and then we could move to strict after that.
You know what? You know what a good example might be is this is from that we don't have you know, the Sarat, and we don't have the Sota anymore.
So right.
Too strict for people.
Yeah, that's a good example.
That's from Hashem. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Good. Yeah. Was there another question someone was asking?
Yeah, I was gonna ask two questions.
Yeah,
they're kind of both on the thing about like how you're saying if everyone just got like a little personalized Torah to them, like it would help them achieve, it would help them achieve perfection.
Yeah.
But my two problems with that are, if we're going to like cater everything to everyone's needs, nobody is achieving perfection anyway, because we're human. So like, is there a really benefit to people being more perfect than they would with like a regular... Actually, no, I just answered my own question. Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not like you're answering your own question. Yeah. But you're reminding me of another point also, which is that, or two other points. One is that, you know, we don't, it's easy for us to underestimate how much more perfection we could get if we had a personalized system. Like, if you think of, if you've ever had a good tutor, okay, and you think, oh, like being tutored personally with my own needs, I get so much more benefit than like in a class that's for everyone. And then if you think that the tutor would be Hashem and that he knows you perfectly, like you would be able to attain perfection in a very, very, very quick, you know, and efficient way. The second point, which I forgot to mention, is that one thing you would lose if all people were, had their own regimen, is you wouldn't have a community. And I'm not saying that that's inherently bad, because maybe you could argue that if everyone was more perfected, they would form their own community based on values instead of based on mitzvos. But given the fact that Hashem wanted to create an am, like a nation, you know, that embodied certain ideas, then having one common system helps towards that end.
Okay, that's a good answer.
Yeah. But would you say that the system of Hashgachat Pratit sort of does that, because people that are on the level, you know, they're Hashgachat Pratit. That thing happened to them, they can take it as like, you know, from Hashem.
Yes. So that is definitely true. Is with Hashgacha Pratis, with personal divine intervention, that is like Hashem's personal guiding mechanism for your perfection. And I guess you see from that, that cases for Hashgacha Pratis that involve like equivalent of mitzvos is not super common. You know, like you have, let's say, for example, Hashem commanding Avram, Lech Lecha, you know, and you have Nevi'im getting specific missions. But for most of the highly perfected people, the Torah was good enough, you know.
Right.
Hashem, most of the time, is just helping them with like material things, like making sure that they don't get sick or starve or get attacked, you know. But the Torah is good enough for those people.
Yeah, sure.
So one of my second questions is going to be like, if the Torah is inherently perfect and meant to accomplish a certain set of values, then Doesn't that mean that anything differing or any sort of laws that differ from the Torah's exact laws won't be able to accomplish those values?
Good question. Good question. The answer is no, but for reasons that I will go into more next time. I'll give you the sneak peek answer, though, which is that the Torah was designed for, like I said, the majority of people for all times and all circumstances. Okay. Let's say, though, that that God gave the Torah today and instead of at that time. So we probably would not have the same amount of agricultural laws. The laws about Avodah Zarah would look very different. We may not even have korbanos, depending on who you ask, you know, which shows you, and God would, I'm sure, design a perfectly good Torah for us, you know? So the idea is that, like, both Torahs, the Torah that God actually gave and the Torah that God could have given today, would accomplish the goals in different ways. Okay, or let me give you another example. Like, and this is an example I got from another author named Menachem Kellner. So he says, you know, Abraham was from Ur Kasdim, okay, which is like in, like, I think Iraq, or modern day Iraq. So there were certain types of Avodah Zarah there, certain type of culture, and certain types of languages. But let's say the person who discovered Hashem was not Abraham. Let's say it was some member of the Navajo tribe in North America, okay? And let's say instead of being in a, I don't know, a farming-based culture, he was in a buffalo hunting culture. And instead of speaking Hebrew, he spoke Navajo. And instead of, like, what, you know, and let's say Hashem blessed that Navajo guy and said, I'll make your descendants into a great nation that will settle in North America. So the Torah for that might look very different also, you know, because it would be addressed to a different population in a different scenario, you know. So theoretically, Hashem could have made lots and lots of different Torahs that all accomplish their goal. It's not that this has to be the one. It's that this is the most perfect Torah for the people who he gave it to at the time he gave it to, given where humanity was at that state. And secondly, there is a statement of Chazal which says, if someone tells you that there is Torah among the non-Jews, don't believe them. But if someone says that there's Chachma among the non-Jews, then believe them. And my understanding of that means that if someone says that there is a system that is better for us, for our perfection, than Torah, don't believe them, because God gave us the best system possible. But if someone says that there's Chachma, meaning there's other ideas and other, like, you know, ways to live according to wisdom among the non-Jews, that's totally fine. Like, we hold that Aristotle and Plato and Epictetus and Seneca and, like, Bruce Lee and, like, you know, all these people, they can have Chachma, and the Chachma could be great. No, they don't have, you know, let's put it this way. We don't have a monopoly. We have a monopoly on Torah. We don't have a monopoly on Chachma, you know? And true, all Chachma is going to be, you know, like, contained in some form in the Torah, but, like, you could have beneficial, like, lifestyles and ideas elsewhere.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Can I ask a question?
So wait.
Who just said, can I ask a question? Yeah, Alishava, go ahead.
Oh, should I go first?
Yeah, go first, yeah.
Okay, so I guess it's on, like, point three, how the Torah is designed to accomplish its goals in all times, places, and cultures.
Yeah.
And I feel like, as a Jew, like, I believe that when it comes to, like, the Torah itself.
Yeah.
But I also feel like it's hard not to say that, like the Rabbanim and, like, a lot of halacha feels very, like, is it a Torah reflecting? How do we know if it's accurately reflecting a value, like, that Hashem wanted it to be? Or right. If it's values from the culture around them that they're assuming are from the Torah.
Right. So that's a good question. And the answer is that because the Torah was given to human beings, then it is subject to imperfection and to mistakes. And the greatest proof of this, anyone who tells you, okay, here's a, you know, Dama Shatati of Apikoros type thing, right? Is you should know the answer to Apikoros. If someone, I'm sure you've talked to people like this who think that rabbis can't make mistakes, okay? And certainly Chazal can't make mistakes, they'll say, right? Now, the easiest answer to that, to refutation to that, is they're humans, they can make mistakes. But let's say someone doesn't accept that answer. What is the greatest proof that Chazal, that Sanhedrin can make mistakes? Other than the fact that that's human nature. And you could prove it from Torah itself. Anyone know? I'll give you a hint. It has to do with korbanos. And I don't know if you've learned this.
The bamos problem?
No. That definitely proves that a lot of people made mistakes. But that's like a chet type mistake. So the answer is that there's...
Oh, that they... Oh, yeah? Okay, I'll let you say. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So there's a korban that a Sanhedrin brings when the Sanhedrin makes a mistake. And that's actually a korban in Torah. So there's a korban for when a Sanhedrin makes a mistake. So it's certainly possible. Yeah?
What is it called?
I'm blanking on it. And I can flip hastily through my Tanakh. I also forgot what parsha it's in. You see, I can make a mistake.
Is it for on Yom Kippur? Doesn't the Kohen Gadol bring a korban or
it
something?
It does, but it's not for a legal body making a mistake. I'm thinking of that specific one. I'm flipping through to try to find it, but until then, so just to respond to Elisheva, so it's true that a Sanhedrin can make a mistake. You see that from here. And any human system is going to be subject to human error. And it's possible that when you see, if we had, you know, a constant Sanhedrin the way that we're supposed to, then it would be possible to overturn things that we saw that were mistaken, you know, in the past. But again, our system is unfortunately frozen because we don't have a Sanhedrin right now, which is, look, if you ask me, and I'm not, this is off the record, although it's being recorded and it's gonna be on YouTube and podcast, but off the record, my biggest desire, my biggest Zionist feeling is I want there to be a Sanhedrin again so that we can start like doing these things. Now, the problem is if we had a Sanhedrin today, it would be messed up because you cannot get the Jews to agree on like whose version of Torah is correct. But like in terms of like why I yearn for like a Jewish state, you know, is I would love there to be a competent Sanhedrin that could like start to address these things, you know? And like, you know, again, we've talked about examples in class, but let's say like certain views about, you know, about women that we see now, that we know now that women are more equal to men than many people believed in terms of their abilities, you know? In terms of, let's say like, you know, Chazal said that, you know, a cheresh, someone who's deaf, is lav bar das, is not someone who has a mental capacity. Well, why was that? Because people who were born deaf never developed language because there was no such thing as sign language back then. So if you saw someone who was born deaf, they were viewed as mentally deranged because every deaf person you saw who was born deaf was mentally deranged. And people assumed that was a matter of nature, not nurture. But now we know from the fact that if you provide the right like cognitive tools, you know, either through technology or through like language devices, you can teach someone who is deaf language and then they could develop, and a person who's born deaf could be just as intelligent as someone who's not born deaf. So maybe halakha would be changed there too. And presumably it would be, you know? So like there's lots of stuff that Chazal were just relying on the best knowledge that they could. And we know that it's wrong. And if you had Chazal who were up to date on science and like psychology and all that other stuff, then you'd be able to change things. But unfortunately, we're frozen. And this is why I said that there is a separate topic which we are not going to address in this year, which is, so what are we supposed to do? Like, is there anything that can be done given the fact that we can't legally modify the system? You know, and what are those individuals who are oppressed by these things or who are, you know, like marginalized by these things, what are they supposed to do? Like, you know, like there's certainly things that we could do to, you know, like there's like another example, for example, like let's say, for example, in meta halakhic stratagems, here's an example, right? Is a woman cannot be a member on the Sanhedrin and a ger cannot be a member on the Sanhedrin. Okay. So what did they do with Devorah? What was the solution that they worked out with Devorah? With the Shofetes?
Her husband was really the leader and she was kind of just his under.
I heard differently. She would basically give fear. Yeah, go ahead. Okay, I can't tell your audio. Yeah, people would come to her and ask questions, and she would basically give shear and like teach all the other members of the Sanhedrin or whatever, and then like someone would like vote on her behalf or whatever, or someone would like intervene. Same thing with Shemaya and Avtalion were two leaders of the Sanhedrin.
Make herself that they would just choose to buy.
I don't know if that was a delayed audio or something. It sounded like it was a delayed audio. I don't know. So Shemaya and Avtalion were two gerim, and gerim cannot be the Nasi and the Av Beis Din. So they basically sat on the sidelines, functioned as the leaders, and then just like someone else officially like did their duties, you know? So like there are these meta halakhic strategies. There are things like that we could do now, and people are trying to work that out, you know, like, you know, ways to be inclusive to people who are excluded by certain halakhic things, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there are solutions, and I think people, it's a lot of it is just like social resistance or cultural resistance and prejudices and stuff like that. So there is a lot we can do. I'm not prepared to address that because it's really complicated. But yeah.
I guess that kind of gives us hope that, like, if we do want to look into it, like, even we know we don't have Sanhedrin, we know we don't have Nevi'im, but like, yeah, there is still stuff that we can do if it's really an issue in the community. And
100%.
We know that we could fight for that.
Yeah, exactly. And look, there are so many people who, whether it's, you know, women's education or whether it's like confronting domestic abuse or drug, you know, drug addiction and the importance of mental health, these things are starting to be on the radars of rabbis and of community leaders. And people are starting to care about this. And like, look, I mean, revolutionary thing during COVID, especially during like last Pesach, of many Orthodox, you know, and even, you know, I think some Haredi poskim saying that if people are alone in isolation, they can use Zoom on Yom Tov because of mental health concerns. You know, like, that's a radical psak that you probably wouldn't have gotten people on board with like 10 years ago, even, you know? So like, it's, you know, there are people who are talking about this. And again, it's a very delicate thing, because if you go too far in hastily like changing halacha, then you lead down the road to conservative and reform, and then things get out of hand. And if you're too strict, then it prevents things, you know, from being solved. And there's an article by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein that has a good middle road approach, which maybe we can go over sometime. I'm just not holding in it to be able to say it, but it does give us hope. You're right. And look, you guys are the next generation, you know, of Jews. I guess I'm kind of, arguably the older people say I'm part of your generation, the younger people say I'm not, but like, you know, the next generation is going to be taking this further than the previous generation. And hopefully like your kids and grandkids will be taking it further than we have right now. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, good. So continue thinking about this again. The plan will be to spend more time on this next time. And if you have questions, then write them down so you don't forget them, and we'll save it for then. Okay. Have a good Shabbos, everybody.
Thank you so much. You too.
Thanks.
If you've gained from what you've learned here today, please consider contributing to my Patreon at www.patreon.com/RabbiSchneeWeiss. Alternatively, if you would like to make a direct contribution to the Rabbi Schneeweiss Torah Content Fund, my Venmo is @Matt-Schneeweiss, and my Zelle/Chase QuickPay and PayPal are MattSchneeweiss@gmail.com. Even a small contribution goes a long way to covering the cost of my podcast and will provide me with the financial freedom to produce even more Torah content for you. If you would like to sponsor an article, shiur, or podcast episode, or if you are interested in enlisting my services as a teacher or tutor, you can reach me at RabbiSchneeweiss@gmail.com. Thank you to my listeners for listening. Thank you to my readers for reading. And thank you to my supporters for supporting my efforts to make Torah ideas available and accessible to everyone.